So we will, I'll just go ahead and get started. So right around noon, this is the lunchtime learning financial education series for the month of June. And today we're going to talk about alternative financial products, as well as the topic of reverse mortgages or home equity conversion mortgages for seniors. We'll just be together about an hour today. I'll give you some overview of these topics and allow some time for Q&A as well. But we'll definitely be done by before the 1 o'clock ending time. There are three handouts, so to speak, that were emailed around. One is a PDF, which is just a Q&A that the Department of Housing and Urban Development in D.C. puts out about home equity conversion mortgages. Another one is a Word document called Alternative Finances, FF Brief. So this is the sort of some of the content for today's call around the alternative financial services. And then finally, a document called HECM Overview. It's just some more detail about the home equity conversion mortgage that we can talk a bit about today. So first I'm going to talk about alternative financial services, a topic which I actually planned this WIS line, I don't know, at least 6 months ago, before everything happened in the Wisconsin State Legislature. So that certainly changes the dynamic of some of what we'll talk about today. But I don't want to just talk about the payday lending and title lending bill that was passed in Wisconsin. We'll talk about this topic more broadly, and then we can hone in on what changes we suspect we might be seeing over the next year, particularly in Wisconsin, as these new laws go into effect. So first, just definitionally, when we talk about alternative financial services, this is a growing and very important market, particularly for a segment of the population which has not had good experiences with the quote-unquote traditional banking sector. I think one of the things as you think about this market, you really have to put yourself in the position of somebody who's had bad experiences with the banking system. This might range everything from there are no banks in my neighborhood or no banks in the places that I tend to go to. When I go into a bank, nobody there looks like me or gives me the time of day. I've gone into a bank before to try to get a loan, and they rejected me. You know, I got a denial, which made me feel really bad about that institution and myself. You know, for some people, they use traditional bank accounts in ways that we don't, we meaning those of us who manage our finances more diligently. So an example might be if you occasionally have trouble meeting your bills every month, you might use your checking account as a way to basically take out a short-term loan by bouncing a check. You know, I don't have enough money. I have no way to come up with the money. I know I can bounce a check. It'll buy me a little bit of time. Yes, I will pay a price for that. But compared to not doing anything, this seems like the way to go. So people will intentionally bounce checks. They'll pay bills late. They'll pay the late fees. They'll pay all the fees. Because if there is no other alternative or the other alternatives are even more costly, then that's what they go for. So, you know, there are people who, you know, maybe they bounce or run into so-called courtesy fees from lenders. Courtesy fees is the nice name for the fees you get charged when you're overdrawn. You know, we've seen people who come into counseling sessions who have $500, $600, $800 a year in those kinds of fees. Those are expensive fees. You know, if you were to try to figure out what the fees are as a percentage of the amount of money people are managing, it's very, very, very high. You know, add to that many finance solutions have moved away from paper statements. They charge for paper statements. They charge for printing checks. You know, lots of little fees that come along. You know, people start to get rather discouraged with these financial institutions. And so when there are more consumer-oriented institutions, meaning they're located in places and hours that are more of my liking, and the fees, while they may be high, don't seem capricious. They just seem high. They're. I know what they are. I know I'm going to hit them, and I prefer that to the fees that I get with the bank, where I just never know when I'm going to get hit next. So that's sort of, you know, the point of view of people in this marketplace sometimes is, yes, the institutions, these alternative financial services may be costly, but compared to my alternatives in the quote-unquote traditional sector, it's really not that costly because I use these kinds of institutions in different ways than perhaps they originally intended. Now, we could have a lively discussion about the fact that all of this is rooted in people's lack of financial management or financial capacity or lack of income or other things, and that would all be true. You know, obviously somebody, even with a pretty tight budget, if they carefully manage their budget, could do quite well with a traditional checking account and a small savings account and never pay these late fees and manage everything quite well.
And certainly in a world where financial educators were on every street corner and available to get to every household and really help people do these kinds of things, that would be true. But unfortunately, we're not in that case. And a lot of people do struggle to try to come up with, you know, the ability to pay really day-to-day expenses. You know, this might be just 2 weeks, being short 2 weeks from now, those kinds of really short-term money management kinds of issues that people come into. So that's essentially the market that the alternative financial service providers are trying to reach. It definitely varies across each of the kinds of different products we'll talk about. You know, some focus more on certain populations than others. And I think that the main thing I hope you come away from this is that we have to be really careful about saying, you know, in a sort of subjective sense, well, there's good and bad providers. There are lots of different providers out there. There are bad traditional providers. There are good traditional providers. There are bad products offered by good traditional providers. I mean, so there's lots of variation out there. And essentially, there are no good guys or bad guys. There are consumers who are struggling to use whatever resources are in front of them. And, you know, sometimes those resources are offered and from more traditional, and sometimes they're offered from more alternative standpoints. But in the end, it's about how people manage these things that really matters. So let me talk first a little bit about each of these different alternative service providers that are out there. You know, the kinds of things we're talking about are check cashers, which might be the corner store check casher, or it might be the check casher in a retail establishment, including grocery stores, which are a big source of check cashers. There's the whole money transmission market, which has been around a long time, the idea of a Western Union or money orders. You know, in essence, the post office plays a role in all this. Remittances, which are important for communities that have high levels of immigrant populations where remittances are going back to other countries. Car title lenders, which is worth understanding a little bit, but also worth knowing that it will no longer exist pretty shortly in Wisconsin. Payday loans, which are a specific but highly visible segment of the market. These are short-term loans, typically from payday to payday, that have gotten a lot of attention in the media. Pawn shops are probably the original alternative financial services that are out there and still, dithering a little bit, still out there and still important for some people to use. And then rent-to-own, which I'm not going to talk a whole lot about today, but really belongs in the same category. Rent-to-own is the appliance and furniture version. We certainly have similar kinds of versions in the used car market where, you know, you buy here, borrow here kind of models where car dealers, particularly used car dealers, look a lot more like banks than they do car dealers. But I won't spend a whole lot of time talking about those markets today. Why do we care about this market? Well, we care about this market because it's growing. You know, you've probably heard the media quotes about how there's more payday lenders than there are Starbucks and McDonald's combined or something like that. You know, there's a lot of these institutions. You can go to many corners and many communities and see multiple institutions, one on each corner. So it's, you know, they tend to be in pretty high traffic locations, storefronts that, you know, oftentimes are, you know, trying to get people in the door. So they're pretty visible. Growing rapidly, you know, but the one estimate from the FDIC is this is about a $320 billion market. Still small relative to the traditional banking sector, but still a lot of institutions, over 13,000 institutions of various types. So by comparison, there's about 8,000 traditional banking institutions. So, you know, we've got a lot of them out there, you know, also highly varied in where they're available. We also care about this market because it is serving the, you know, sort of vulnerable consumer. Tends to be a lot of lower income families, lesser educated families, oftentimes heavily used by people that are not native of the United States or immigrants. So we, you know, we see a volume of business that might make you concerned that somehow it's preying upon people who don't have access to traditional services or maybe don't have the knowledge of what other services might be out there. So let me start with, you know, each of these sort of case by case. Check cashers are probably one of the more innocuous of the alternative financial services. Typically, they just do one thing, they cash a check. You have a paper check and you want to make it into cash, so you take it in to a check casher. This is something you could do at any financial institution. In fact, most financial institutions will cash checks for you know, non-customers and non-other bank accounts. They'll charge a fee just like the check cashers do, much like many grocery stores will and other retail stores. So it's, you know, it's a pretty widely available service. Why people might use a check cashier? Well, one is convenience. I mean, that's a predominant reason, is that the location or the hours are when they want to use them. And they want the cash. They don't want a direct deposit. They, for some reason, want cash. The fees really range here. Some credit unions might, and retailers, particularly if you're going to spend money there, might charge a very low fee. Other, corner check cashers might charge 4 or 5% of the face value of the check, which could, for a small check, or a large check, could really add up. You know, typically you see a surge of this business around paydays or around dates that government checks are set. So checks for public assistance or other benefits or, you know, major employers. One thing to note is that federal benefits, and I suspect most states will follow suit, are moving away from paper checks. And in fact, by 2013, there will be no more issuance of paper checks. Many businesses are going this route, too. They don't want to pay their employees in paper checks. There are many reasons for this. One is concerns about the fees associated with check cashing, which is sort of noble, but probably not a primary driver. Primary driver is that it costs. Issuing, printing, handling, and distributing paper is more challenging than just doing the electronic transfer. Electronic transfers are also faster. These automatic deposits are faster. They are pretty easy to track, so we know exactly what was transferred when and how much, and you know, we have confirmations and those kinds of things. So it certainly will probably benefit consumers who have bank accounts to have direct deposit or use of a prepaid card, which we'll talk about in a minute. But, you know, the other advantage is that people won't have to manage these paper checks. Whether, people have been suggesting that the paper check is going to be extinct for probably 20 years. We obviously still, most of us still have checkbooks and still use checkbooks. So paper checks probably aren't going to totally go away. But, you know, once these federal benefits and then state benefits follow suit, we certainly will see a lot fewer checks. And what that means for check cashing industry, I'm not exactly sure. Potentially, there'll be less volume, and actually costs might go up a little bit, but it's hard to know exactly.
Michael, what's going away in 2013, the federal checks?
Yeah, no federal benefits will be paid on paper.
Okay, thanks.
It'll all be electronic, and most states will follow suit. So you only would have private party checks, so employers and then party-to-party checks at that point. So prepaid cards are one solution for people who don't have checking accounts but need to do electronic transfers. So prepaid cards are, I think we may have even done one of these calls about the prepaid card, the open loop market. These are, you know, debit cards that are not linked to a bank account. So essentially all the stored value is on the card. You don't have to have an account behind it. They're issued by all kinds of institutions. Many specialize just in this kind of market. Others are, you know, Citigroup or Bank of America. They'll issue these prepaid value cards. Sometimes they're actually called payroll cards. So if you've worked much, I think it's with the Department of Corrections. They do this with their employees who don't have bank accounts. They issue their payroll checks on these payroll cards. They look and act just like a debit card. They have a PIN number. You swipe them, you put in the PIN number. With many of them, it will then send you a text message about your current balance, or you can go online and look at your balance. For consumers who are used to the prepaid cell phones, the stored value debit card is an attractive product because it seems very similar. I load the card just like I load my phone with some amount of money, and then I spend it down, and then I reload it again. So it has a sort of comforting feel to it. This is a small market but growing rapidly, and what's interesting is that there's a lot of people who are choosing the prepaid or payroll cards, even who have bank accounts. So they're using the card as an alternative to their bank account. It's not that they couldn't get a bank account, they just like, there's something they like about it better. So some of the things they like about it better are that it's convenient, that, you know, they feel like they have some control over, you know, how they spend their money, and it allows them to track their spending in a way that, you know, you probably could do with a traditional bank account, but in some ways these cards are really set up to help you do that. So you can segregate your funds into different categories. And it lets you know sort of where you are in each category. You could essentially use it as a budgeting tool. Or some people will put some money into their prepaid card, spend it till it's gone, but then not reload it until, you know, next payday. So it's a way to sort of control their spending. When it's paid down, they can't keep spending. One of the things that people who have had bad experiences with checking and overdrafting is you can't overdraft with these. If you go to make a swipe, you don't have money in the account, it won't go through. So it's a way to prevent yourself from doing the overdraft. The problems in this market, well, it's it's a highly varied market. There are some cards which are very low cost. It doesn't cost anything to load the card. So every time you put money on it, there's no fee. And then they may just charge an annual fee or a monthly fee that's pretty low, sometimes $3, $4 a month. Sometimes they'll charge a fee per transaction. And then some cards have high fees. So you pay to load it, you pay to spend it, you pay at an ATM, you pay when you use it online. So those fees can really add up for some of these cards. So it's a case where the card itself isn't necessarily good or bad. You have to really look at the terms and conditions of it and how it works. You know, the advantages for a lot of people, if they don't have a bank account, is it gives them the ability to almost have a credit card. So you could use the debit cards for things like gasoline and hotels, which, you know, in many cases, they require the use of some kind of a debit or credit card. So they have some benefits in that regard. But it definitely is worth shopping around. And for some people, it's a behavior management tool. So they'll have it in addition to a savings account, to a checking account. For others, it's their alternative to those accounts because they've had bad experiences in those markets, or in some cases, they just can't get. They've had such poor management of checking accounts in the past, this is their only option. This is a growing market. Again, as the use of federal benefits and federal payroll moves to all electronic in 2013, those people who don't have bank accounts, these payroll or prepaid stored value cards will be the primary alternative. We're going to see the same thing with tax refunds, a movement towards the electronic stored value cards for people who don't have bank accounts. So it's going to be an area where more and more people are using these cards. And I wouldn't be surprised in a few years, we all have a card or two that we carry around, you know, much like maybe we do now for a retail closed loop card. We may have open loop cards that we have for different programs that we might be involved in.
Two questions, Michael. You said something about having categories so they could use it as a budgeting tool. Could you speak more about that? And also then you said about charges for those fees. If my business that I'm working for, I get a prepaid card for my salary, how would I have any choice of which prepaid card I would be using?
So the last question first. Typically what happens if you don't have a bank account, then you'll be issued one of these cards. But you can, if you don't like the card you're issued, you could always get a different card and just give that account number to your employer. So you could always swap out. But what most people do is they'll just take whatever their employer gives them. So it is something for employees to be cautious about. Typically when I've seen this in practice, it's been state agencies that do this, so they are pretty mindful about which card they pick and how it affects their employees. But it is something to keep an eye on. Your first question was, you have to remind me.
The first question, you had talked about having categories so they could use it as a budgeting tool.
Could
you speak on that?
Yeah, so not every card does this, but I would say the particularly the banks that are getting into this market now are tending to add more bells and whistles. So one of those is connecting the card to a website. And on that website, I can have different purse. I can have different parts of my purse. Sometimes that's the way they describe it. So I can, you know, set up a part of my purse for this purpose, another part of my purse for this purpose. And I can always move money back and forth, but it can force me to budget. So I might say, you know, I have $1,000 in my account. I'm going to put $500 aside in the purse for this purpose, and $500 I can freely spend. So it gives me the ability to do that. It also allows me to do some categorization. So when you go to swipe the card, it records where you did that transaction. So was it a gas station, a grocery store? There's different categories of spend, so you can track your spending and budgeting that way, and you know, sort of basically create your daily spending habits off of those websites. They're connecting more and more to these online reminder type websites where, you know, you can get updates on where you're at relative to what your original budgeting goals were. So it's becoming more and more sophisticated, particularly with the advent of the texting and mobile phone. So it says, you know, you have so much left in your balance, you have so much in your purse, you spent so much in this category, you spent so much in this category. And it can, you know, literally remind you every time you make a purchase or every day or however, you know, you can set it up however you'd like. All right, now we'll move to the big one, which is the payday lending. So payday loans are an interesting, very interesting market. These are, you know, short-term liquidity tools. These are for people who can't make it to the end of the month, so to speak. You know, meaning they are employed, they have a checking account. Those are, you know, generally true for people who use payday lending. They're employed and they have a checking account. And they're having trouble making ends meet until that next check comes. So they know they have $800 coming to them, but that's a week and a half away, and the rent is due now, or something else is due now. You know, sometimes it's a car repair, who knows what it is, and they just need the cash now. You know, there's been lots of studies of payday lending, who uses payday lending, what do they do before they resort to the payday loan, what other things are they juggling? And so, they're juggling, but what happens if I don't pay this? What are the fees that I get hit with if I bounce a check or if I don't get a bill paid on time? And, you know, sometimes those fees, you know, of a bounce check and a late payment on a particular bill might be pretty high. They might be $75, $80 from a single event, because you'll get levied a fee by your institution and by the other institution. You know, it can add up pretty quickly. So what people will do is go to a payday lender and essentially write a check, and the check won't be cashed until the next payday. And the amount that you get today forwarded from that next check is less. So, you know, typically it's a cost per hundred. You know, the fees really vary, but they're high. I mean, there's no question about it. You know, you might pay, you know, in a good deal, you know, $20 per hundred or $10 per hundred. I mean, all different kinds of fees that people may pay. But if you multiply out these APRs and your percentage rates, they're hundreds of percent, sometimes thousands of percent. And so that tends to be what hits the media is, well, if this person rolled this loan over for every 2 weeks for a whole year, they would pay a 2,000% interest rate, which is true. But they don't do the alternative, which is, you know, if this person were to have not taken out that payday loan but paid a late fee and, you know, a bounce check fee for every month for 12 months, that's also a large fee. So, I mean, it's really, the APR is sort of a misleading thing. It's how much, these are folks who are very liquidity constrained. They don't have enough cash to get through. So they're looking at various alternatives, and those other alternatives are also very costly. And so it's not that people are short-sighted. It's not that they don't know how much they're being charged. It's that this is the best of a number of particularly poor alternatives. It's kind of the least worst, if you don't think of it that way. By and large, if you ever go into a payday lending operation, they're pretty clear about what you're going to pay. The fees are pretty clear. Interviews with consumers are either in the store or when they leave the store. It's, people know how much they're paying. They know it's costly. They're hopeful that they won't have to roll this loan more than a couple of times, even though on average they tend to roll it four or five times. But people will come back again. They know what these fees are. They're pretty clear. There's not a lot of trickiness in terms of how they're designed, other than people tend to be over-optimistic about their ability to be able to catch up again. If people use these things judiciously, meaning they occasionally use them to get them through a couple of weeks and not roll the loan, they probably are the cheapest alternative, arguably maybe even cheaper than turning to friends and family because of the, you know, all the hassles involved with borrowing from friends and family. It may just be easier. The problem is that most people, if you're in this market, you may be really struggling to make ends meet. And so the odds of you actually being able to catch up in 2 weeks are pretty low without making something else cut. The danger in these products is that there tends to be a lot of movement from one payday loan to another loan, or payday loans to credit cards, and then back to credit loans. And so people tend to get in these cycles where it's not just that they're taking out payday loans, it's the combination of payday loans, credit cards, you know, sometimes title, auto title loans, sometimes pawn, and it's sort of a trying to make ends meet by using whatever resources are available, and the payday loan sort of is one of those in the cycle. It's also true that people will sometimes hit multiple payday loans, so they'll not just take out one, but multiple. So one of the reasons why we have so many different four on a corner is that people might hit two or three. It's not just a matter of using one institution, but multiple institutions. It is actually hard to generalize about the payday loan consumer. There are certainly people who do use these infrequently and in a way that actually makes them better off. And it's also true that there are people who use these very frequently, if not all the time, and pay a lot for that service. And it's not clear that they are better off for that. The industry obviously makes a lot of money on the latter. And so there's a lot of concern about whether the industry is taking advantage of people, whether they're being misleading, whether the fees are just too high, and whether we should try to regulate those fees. Many states have gone towards policies where you actually regulate the fee. You say that the APR can't be more than 36%. That seems to be a pretty common number that's used out there. And what happens is the payday loan industry tends to go away in those states. It effectively bans them. And so there's good and bads, and there's winners and losers when that happens. And there has been some research by the Federal Reserve where they looked at particularly North Carolina, which imposed a law that would effectively largely push the payday lender out of the state. The incident of bounced checks went up, and the fees that people were paying went up. So whether or not they're better off or not is sort of an open question. I think the biggest issue that payday lending brings out is that there are a lot of people who are really on the edge and don't have enough money to get by. And, as we've been reminded so many times, credit is not a substitution for income. People can get by in a short run by borrowing if they don't have enough income. But in the long run, there's no income. And so it's just hard to make that happen. Actually, payday lending is probably just another symptom of just how financially strapped, particularly people with the more vulnerable low-income populations are. In terms of what's happening policy-wise in Wisconsin, there's been debate about regulating payday lending in Wisconsin for years. Historically, Wisconsin has been one of the lightest regulated payday lending states in the country. Unlike other states, payday lenders had to register, so the state actually knew how many payday lenders there were and who they were owned by and where they were located. So that's sort of unique that I think it was DFI actually was doing some tracking of payday lending activity, or at least the institutions. But there was no cap on interest rate and no limit on loan amount or anything else. So somewhat different from other states. This spring, there was a law passed in the Assembly and the Senate that went to the governor that would limit payday loans, the amount, and how often they could be rolled over. There was a lot of debate about this, whether this was good or bad, whether it hurt people or not. The limit was $1,500, which is pretty big. The average payday loan is about $400. It's probably higher than would actually constrain anybody over time. And there's no limit on interest rate. So still, they can charge as high an annual interest rate as they'd like. And one of the major provisions of the law is that new payday lenders can't be located within 150 feet of certain residential areas or within 1,500 feet of each other. A reporter asked me about whether I thought this would make any difference. I'm not an urban planner, so I can't really say. But my observation is that I don't know that we could use, even if the payday lenders wanted to come in and relocate, they've already got most of the corners that are available. So I'm not sure if that law is going to really prohibit much because it doesn't affect the already existing institutions. So maybe we won't get quite as many per corner. Maybe we'll only get two per corner instead of four per corner. But that cow is probably already out of the barn, so to speak. So in the end, does this law really have much effect? Maybe. I mean, I think maybe this is just the beginning of legislation, and in future years there'll be stricter legislation around fees or disclosures, both of which might help people not get so much caught in that debt trap over time. Perhaps we're going to see some lowering of that loan limit. There is some, at least, language about trying to track people's use of these loans so that they don't use multiple lenders in a consistent period. I think that'll be hard to see how that actually plays out, and how well that'll be tracked and how much that really limits people. I think if nothing else, this legislation is good because it really highlights this issue of payday lenders, how they're being used, and, potentially the financial literacy education need of particularly this population that uses that market. So you may ask yourself, well, this is kind of not exactly a positive story about payday lending, nor the current situation in Wisconsin. And I'm open to questions about this, but I also want to share first some, I think, what is pretty positive, which is an FDIC small dollar pilot. There's only 28 banks nationwide that are involved in this pilot, and two of them are here in Wisconsin, both savings and loans. And they're offering small dollar loans. There's actually some credit unions that were doing this even before the FDIC pilot. I think of the good money loans in Appleton that the Goodwill Credit Union and the credit union is doing with the goodwill there. But so there are examples of outside of the FDIC small dollar pilot, but that small dollar pilot is important because this is FDIC regulated institutions, and they're really trying to encourage lenders to do these small dollar loans, loans of up to $1,000, where you know the APRs are pretty low, where fees are limited, and where people can hopefully be able to pay them back and get caught up again. You know, lenders will say that these small dollar loans are expensive to make and expensive to maintain, and that's why they have to charge such high fees. And so this pilot is a nice way to try to, you know, prove that this actually can't be done.
Does City Financial have some of these small dollar loans as well?
You know, I don't know if any of the major institutions are in the pilot or not. So I'll briefly touch on the last two topics, and then we can move on to the reverse mortgages. So, you know, I just want to make sure we keep pawn lending in the mix because, you know, what we do see in places where payday lending goes down is pawn lending goes up. Pawn lending's been around for thousands of years. You know, it's essentially where you take something to the pawnbroker, you get some cash for it, and you could go back and buy it later for a much higher cost. But, you know, the lender essentially keeps the collateral and resells it whenever they get the opportunity. So it's a little bit like resale, except essentially your original payment on that thing was a loan with the idea that you might be able to get that money back. It's not a highly regulated industry. Tends to be a lot of smaller mom-and-pop kind of operations. There is some consolidation. You're seeing, you know, some national parties get involved in pawn, you know, and they tend to do multiple things. So they'll do pawn and check cashing and a few other things sometimes. But it's still out there and something that many people take advantage of. And then finally, there's auto title lending, which traditionally has been a way for you to take some of the equity that you might have in your car and borrow against it to take out a relatively short-term, very high-cost loan. Oftentimes, it's a standalone operation. Sometimes it's associated with a used car dealer. And sometimes it's the used car dealer that does the buy here, pay here kind of model. You know, this has been a growing market. It's in some ways one of those other options that people in the payday lending market would turn to at occasional points in time to take some equity out of their car and then slowly pay that off. I don't know the scale of how big it was in Wisconsin, but effectively at the end of this year, it will go away because of, as I understand, the bill that was passed by the Senate and the legislature and went to Governor Doyle's desk didn't ban it, but he was able to strike out certain words of a sentence that basically said, and no entity will be able to make an auto title loan. And so it was kind of a Mad Lib approach to legislation. But, it, you know, I think there was some good logic into why this industry is really hard to understand, and there's been a number of class action suits filed against some pawn or some title lenders in the state of Wisconsin because of misrepresentation. And you know, at the end of the day, it was a market that was still pretty small, troubling in a lot of ways, given how it was structured. And so the governor's decision was, you know, I'll let the payday lending keep going, but I'll get rid of the auto title lending. You know, the reaction to it has been actually pretty mild. I've been surprised, which may be that maybe this industry wasn't very big, but it essentially will be going away.
Michael, what's your advice? I never thought about the issue of payday lending versus, you know, having bounce checks, which I understand very expensive. Let's say someone has an incident where maybe their car breaks down and they got to get it hauled back home and get it fixed and they don't have enough money. What would you suggest to people trying to find these small dollar loan places as much as they can, or what? How do you help them think through those times when they don't have enough?
Right. I mean, obviously, in a perfect world, people would budget and they would have an emergency savings account. They would have a rainy day account. But even then, sometimes it rains twice in a row, right? So
right.
You know, you spend the rainy day account, it's gone.
Yeah.
This is where having a credit card could be an advantage. Again, people can get in trouble with a credit card. And it's having a credit card and not spending it to its limit, so you have some availability there that's important. And so that's usually the first line of defense would be, you know, to have a credit card that you can use in a judicious way for these kinds of unforeseen emergencies and then really work to pay that off.
The problem is many of my clients can't have a credit card anymore because of other issues that have happened. So if that's not one of the options,
then you're solidly in the payday loan market, mm-hmm. and all you can really do is try to shop around. As you, the example you just gave is a perfect example, because you don't have a lot of time to shop around. You know,
right.
You're sort of in a crisis, and the differences in fees across these firms are pretty minimal. So even if you went to all four corners to visit each store, you might not get a whole lot of variation in fees. So, you know, it's important for people to be really mindful about what they're getting into and then have a plan on how they're going to get out of it. So certainly shopping around a little bit, it makes sense. Generally, like I said, most of the corner store operations are going to be pretty similarly priced. So it's just a matter of whether there's a credit union or other institution that does more of the small dollar model, which might be a better option. And if those don't exist, then you got to pick from one of those four on the corner. And regardless, you have to have a plan to get out of it, which means I'm going to cut back on something to make it possible for me to pay this back. And that's the sort of more severe, you know, the austerity budget that people have to go through that sometimes is hard. But, you know, there's, for some people, there just really aren't a lot of other options. And so it's just a matter of making the budget work given that circumstance.
Great, thank you. So shop around, but again, I may not have much time to do that, and then think about what changes I'm going to make to be able to pay it off as quickly as possible.
Right, exactly. No matter what, you got to do that, whether you do credit card, payday loan, borrow from friends and family.
And these small dollar loans, you know, that to me seems like the greatest opportunity if we can, you know, if this could work better.
Right. I think that's exactly right. And that's why the FDIC is invested in this
okay.
pilot, to try to prove the concept. And I would say if you have bank partners, talk to them about that pilot if they don't know about it.
Yeah. Well, I have a daughter who works at City Financial, and their rates are quite high. I mean, it's located right in a shopping mall.
Yep.
And I'm going to talk to her, because I think, as I understood from her, those loans could be that small. And to me, again, even though I look at that and think, oh, my gosh, the rates are still very high, it probably would be cheaper than payday loans. So if we know about those as we're working with clients, that might be something to talk through with them.
Definitely. I mean, some people just don't know the options. So it's important to let them know that, you know, there is more than just the corner store.
Yeah, and they check rates.
Mm-hmm.
Great.
This is Jennifer from Washira, just kind of building off of what you folks are saying, and just having met with two clients who are neck deep in multiple predatory lender loans. I thought the same thing. Maybe they could go and get, you know, the $1,500 or $500 from a regular financial institution. They were telling me, though, that their credit score was incredibly low, like 400 or something, and even with a traditional financial institution, I don't even think they would necessarily be offered an unsecured loan for $500. Would they necessarily with that poor of a credit history?
Some of the credit union products don't do credit check, just like the payday lenders don't do credit check. So it is possible. The credit score for, you know, once your credit score is already damaged that heavily, you're probably not going to find a credit card. So it is going to be pretty challenging to find any other kind of credit besides a payday loan or one of these very specialized small dollar loans. The thing I didn't mention is that there has been a growth recently of the payday loan on the internet, which we don't know a whole lot about yet. But, you know, people more and more can get these loans. So that's what, you know, some of these states that have these strict laws, they're really being skirted because people can get the loan on the internet. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out.
So the internet doesn't have the same regulations, Michael?
Well, it regulates the location of the lender, not the location of the borrower. So if you set up shop in a state that has lax laws...
Buyer beware.
Yeah.
Can you speak a little bit about the small dollar loan FDIC pilot? Is that affected by credit score, do you know, Michael?
Those are generally not credit scored, although I think institution can choose to do that. But I the ones I've seen are not credit scored. They're more like a payday loan. Right, well, I'm glad there's interest in this topic. But I also want to get onto the reverse mortgage topic, too. So, and we can always do another call on these topics if there's a lot of interest. So reverse mortgages, many of you may have at least heard of these things, and they have a funny name. Like there's a forward mortgage and a reverse mortgage. I didn't know that. But reverse mortgages are more technically known as home equity conversion mortgages. They're aimed at people who are 62 and older, so essentially seniors. who own their home and who are house rich but cash poor. So they need money to get by. And, you know, typically the mantra in retirement savings is that you want to put money aside so you can spend it down in retirement. But if you put money into your house, how do you spend it down? You can't get the money back out. And really, you're just stuck with it until you sell it or, you know, your estate sells it or hands it off to your heirs. So you might say, well, that's simple. You know, you just sell your house and then move to a rental apartment and then you'll be fine. But those of you who know people who are over age 62, they don't really want to move. They want to stay in their house. And so in some ways, they're sort of stuck. You know, they have this, they want to stay where they are. They're happy. They're probably healthier and you know, whatever else for staying. Yet they, you know, they want to get some cash out of their house. And so the home equity reverse, the home equity conversion mortgage or reverse mortgage is essentially a way to deal with that problem. It's a pretty small market. So nationally, 10 years ago, I think there were maybe 25,000 of these loans in the whole country. Today, there's about 100,000 loans in the whole country. We're reaching towards 150,000 of these loans, these HECM loans, which are insured by the FHA, Federal Housing Administration. So it's still a pretty small market, and a very small number of seniors are using these. But what's interesting is that this is a market that's growing really fast, even since 2008. So in 2008, as you probably know, the entire mortgage market hit the skids, and almost no loans were being made. Yet home equity conversion mortgages have continued to grow. So the story here is twofold. I mean, one is that this is a market that's backed by the FHA, so it has the backing of the government, and isn't stuck sort of in the credit retrenchment that the rest of the mortgage market is. The other is that as the recession hit, a lot of seniors had money invested in things like stocks and even bonds that really did poorly. So they were counting on income from their investments that wasn't coming through. And so they looked around at the equity in their house, which although their equity wasn't as high as it was maybe 3 or 4 years before, it was a lot higher than 30 years ago when they bought the house. So they had equity tapped. So we saw some growth in this market. There's a concern, however, that some of those subprime lenders that we hear so many horror stories about in the boom, subprime boom, have just moved their brokerage operations over to home equity conversion mortgages. So we have some shady characters potentially in this market. And a lot of concern about seniors being taken advantage of as this market grows. So I don't want to go too much into the details of these kinds of loans, but they're essentially, you know, I think in Wisconsin I looked and there's several hundred lenders who are active in the state of Wisconsin providing home equity conversion mortgages. Many financial solutions don't do these loans primarily because it takes some time and energy to learn how to do them, to do all the paperwork and, you know, the applications and everything else that's involved. So some institutions don't do them. Some do a lot of them. And so you tend to get some firms and even departments within firms that really specialize in this market. The loans are essentially you're taking a lump sum payment today that's paid off when the home is sold. And the home might be sold when you move or when your estate sells the house on your behalf. And that's what pays off the loan. There's really no chance of foreclosing because it's not paid off until the house is sold. So it's not a case where you're putting your house at risk. But it is reducing the amount that your heirs potentially are going to get because you're spending spending down this equity that may have been originally part of your estate. And this is probably the biggest sticking point with these loans. Well, it's one of two big sticking points with these loans is that children and heirs don't like them because, you are paying down, you know, the equity. So there won't be as much equity there. If they hope to inherit the home, they're going to inherit a home that has a loan on it. And if they weren't hoping to inherit the equity, that equity will be spent. So that's one issue. The other big issue is that these loans have big fees. And so, you know, a fee of $15,000, $20,000 might not be crazy or out of the ordinary. So, you know, there's a lot of worry about brokers or lenders taking advantage of the system to try to take advantage of you know, what's seen as an unsophisticated borrower who hasn't been on the mortgage market for quite a while. Sometimes it's a, you know, elderly person or a widow. And so there's a lot of concern about whether they really knew that they were paying these big fees, you know, home equity that's essentially going to the lender or broker's pocket. So how do these things work? Well, you apply, and the application is you're not really applying based on your ability to repay the loan because there isn't a monthly payment here. What you're applying for is whether there's enough value in your home to get you the payment that you want. So it's a combination of how much your home is worth, how much equity is in it. If you have any, typically there's not many, any loans on these properties, so they own them free or clear. They have a small mortgage. So they figure out how much equity is there. And then how old you are. So essentially they're trying to figure out how long it's going to be until they might recoup the original value of the home to pay off the loan. And then you can decide to take the money in different ways. So you can take it as a monthly payment, so it's kind of like an annuity. So you just hand over a chunk of money to get back a stream of money over time. So you can sort of think of it that way. Or you can think about it more as a sort of fixed payment. So I'm going to get, you know, a certain amount of money for a certain amount of time. So it can be either way. Another option is actually a line of credit, where I just really want the option to be able to take out money from my home if I need it, but otherwise I won't. And this is probably the most frequently what we see. Well, originally it was designed to be more of an annuity product where you got money out until your death. And so that makes it actually pretty complicated from a financial standpoint, because annuities are somewhat complicated. Then you have this whole, you know, payoff with the loan, the value of the home. So that made it more complicated. But what it turns out most people do is the line of credit. They really want the option to be able to tap the equity if they need it, but not if they don't. Most lenders do make people take out some amount, just because, you know, that's how they get paid, is by having some activity there. So typically there's an initial line of credit draw and then further lines as needed. There are many options here. So you could do a combination of annuity plus line of credit, or different variations here, and you can see some of those described here. But essentially the process is still the same. We figure out how much your house is worth. We figure out, you know, what your life expectancy is and how much you can borrow. I think the current limit on the size of these loans is something like $625,000. So it's pretty big. This is under the FHA program, which is most of these loans are made under FHA, particularly now. And there are upfront fees, which include the mortgage insurance premium, which goes to FHA to insure against the loss. And then there is the fee that goes to the lender. And then there's a servicing fee as well. You know, typically, if it's a monthly payment, they take some portion of the monthly payment. So they are certainly not simple products to understand, particularly for somebody, like I said, who's been out of the mortgage market for a long time. So one of the things that is required under this program is for people to get counseling. So there are certified HUD, or Housing and Development Counselors, who are HECM, Home Equity Conversion Mortgage Certified, and they work a lot with the AARP to make sure that everybody who gets a home equity conversion mortgage goes through some kind of counseling to figure out if they really understand, and you know, help them figure out if they really understand the fees, the terms, how much they're borrowing, how much their house is worth, what it means for the heirs, that kind of thing. National Council on Aging has a free booklet you can find online or in the 1-800 number that's listed in the Q&A that I sent around, that you can use with clients who might be thinking about these products. So AARP is a good source. The National Counseling Agency is a good source. And then everybody who goes through the program has to get some counseling. The counseling has to occur. This isn't suggest it. So, you know, I guess the major thing I would say about these products is that they are growing. They are complicated, and people need help to think them through. But they are, you know, they can be valuable for seniors, particularly as their investment portfolios and their other options that they have available to them are dwindling. The biggest issue here tends not to be financial, but the family and social and those kinds of things. So those of you who are involved in projects with seniors and with intergenerational work probably are quite familiar with this. But, you know, this sort of dispute over how the money's going to be used is a big concern. So any questions about these products? There is a publication that is available through the Learning Store on estate planning, and it currently doesn't have anything in there about reverse mortgages, but that's something I've been talking with Karen and other people about as they update that document to include a bit more about this, what this means for estate planning, how it can be an estate planning tool, and the resources that are available out there for consumers. AARP has a nice website on this topic. And they actually have a calculator, so you can start to figure out how much you might be able to borrow, given the equity in your house and given your age. And then the housing counseling agencies that are available are mostly available through a 1-800 number, although there are, I think I looked and there's 20 agencies in Wisconsin that also do face-to-face HECM counseling. So the fees for these counseling sessions are highly regulated by HUD, so they make sure that people aren't being that the counseling is both provided by a nonprofit and that the content and the provider are licensed or, you know, credentialed in their in their system, and then are you know, not taking advantage of people just to get through the counseling.
This is Sherry, and I just wanted to make a comment kind of in support of what you were saying. I've seen these mortgages get a lot of negative publicity, but I've seen seniors who can't even afford their medications and their children prevent them from taking them because they want the equity. So it really is complicated, like you said, with the heirs and the family members involved. And the counseling does a good job of eliminating some of that miscommunication. But sometimes family members just tell people they're bad and they don't ever get that far.
Yeah, it's one of the biggest problems with these products is that sort of intergenerational conflict that it brings up. And, of course, you could have that same conversation about, you know, any number of other financial decisions that people are making, you know. So, you know, as an heir, I might be just as concerned about somebody spending down bank account balances, but that doesn't require quite the level of action that these ones do. All right, any other questions or comments on the reverse market? Okay, well, I want to thank everybody for tuning in today. We're going to do another call. Actually, next week, let me first give a plug for next week, we're doing the Building Buck series. We're sort of kicking off, depending on how you're thinking about it, we're either wrapping up last year's series or we're kicking off the series for next season, so to speak. So Building Bucks, for those of you who don't know that, is a sort of an introduction to a whole bunch of financial literacy-related topics. We have sort of one topic per month, and we go through them in order over a 10-month period. So we're kicking that off next Monday at 1 o'clock. Those are the on the second Monday of the month, we do these calls, the Lunchtime Learning, and on the third Monday, we do the Building Bucks. So that will kick off / wrap up next week. And then next month in July, for this call, I'd like to talk about the topic of savings bonds, but I, you know, as usual, if something else is more pressing, we can address that. So just let me know if you have some other pressing issues. But until then, have a great week.